translation. Knowing that Bhishma Dev had merged into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute, all present there became silent like birds at the end of the day. Purport, Vaishnava Prabhupada. To enter into or to become merged into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute means to enter the original home of the living being. The living beings are all component parts and parcels of the Absolute Personality of Godhead, and therefore they are eternally related with Him as the servitor and the served. The Lord is served by all His parts and parcels, as a complete machine is served by its parts and parcels. Any part of the machine removed from the whole is no longer important. Similarly, any part and parcel of the Absolute detached from the service of the Lord is useless. The living beings who are in the material world are all disintegrated parts and parcels of the Supreme Whole, and they are no longer as important as the original parts and parcels. There are, however, more integrated living beings who are eternally liberated. The material energy of the Lord, called Durga Shakti, or the superintendent of the material energy of the Lord, superintendent of the prison house, takes charge of the disintegrated parts and parcels, and thus they undergo a conditioned life under the laws of material nature. When the living being becomes conscious of this fact, he tries to go back home, back to Godhead, and thus the spiritual urge of the living being begins. This spiritual urge is called Brahma Jignasa, or inquiry about Brahman. Principally, this Brahma Jignasa is successful by knowledge, renunciation, and devotional service to the Lord. Gyan, or knowledge, means knowledge of everything of Brahman, the Supreme. Renunciation means detachment of material affection. And devotional service is the revival by practice of the original position of the living being. The successful living beings who are eligible to enter into the realm of the Absolute are called the Jnanis, the Yogis, and the Bhaktas. The Jnanis and the Yogis enter into the impersonal rays of the Supreme, but the Bhaktas enter into the spiritual planets, known as the Vaikunthas. In these spiritual planets, the Supreme Lord as Narayan predominates, and the healthy, unconditioned living beings live there by rendering loving service to the Lord in the capacity of servant, friend, parents, and fiancé. There, the unconditioned living beings enjoy life in full freedom with the Lord, whereas the impersonalist, Jnanis and Yogis, enter into the impersonal glowing effulgence of the Vaikuntha planets. The Vaikuntha planets are self-illuminating like the sun, and the rays of the Vaikuntha planets are called the Brahma Jyoti. The Brahma Jyoti is spread unlimitedly, and the material world is but a covered portion of an insignificant part of the same Brahma Jyoti. This covering is temporary, and therefore it is a sort of illusion. Bhishma Dev, as a pure devotee of the Lord, entered the spiritual realm in one of the Vaikuntha planets, where the Lord in his eternal form of Parthasarathi predominates over the unconditioned living beings, who are constantly engaged in the service of the Lord. The love and affection which bind the Lord and devotee are exhibited in the case of Bhishma Dev. Bhishma Dev never forgot the Lord in his transcendental feature as the Parthasarathi, and the Lord was present personally before Bhishma Dev while he was passing to the transcendental world. That is the highest perfection of life. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadam Ayaham Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeyaham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tvam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Prishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye vancha kalpa trubhyascha kripa sindhu bhavacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadha shivasadi gaura bhakta vrinda hare krishna hare krishna 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 hare 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 rama hare rama 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 there are so many detailed points and deep points that Srila Prabhupada makes in the purport. So I thought maybe we could just go through section by section the different points that are being made and just maybe try and break it down a little bit. Just reciting the verse again. So knowing that Bhishma Dev had merged into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute, all present there became silent, like birds at the end of the day. So as we've heard through this chapter, description of Bhishma Dev's and the essence of his instructions to Yudhishthira Maharaj and the scene of how Krishna had arranged for Yudhishthira Maharaj to inquire from Bhishma Dev. Is later set out, and here the text when you first hear it, it's maybe a little bit confusing because it talks about merging into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute, which sounds a little impersonal. So, luckily for Srila Prabhupada's purport, in the first line he clarifies. So he says to enter into or to become merged into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute means to enter the original home of the living entity. So this idea that merging from a devotional perspective, of course, means something different to what it might mean for an impersonalist. I read somewhere in third canto, I think I've got a reference. Yeah, chapter 28, verse 35. Srila Prabhupada talks about this word nirvana. So nirvana is often used in this context of kind of an impersonal voidism or merging, or, you know, it's sometimes a bit nondescript, but this idea of that could be confused also with impersonalism. And Srila Prabhupada makes a really kind of important point here so that we can understand what that nirvana means actually for us in our context. So he says that this nirvana is essentially the dovetailing of the mind with the desires of the Lord. So when the mind is dovetailed with the desires of the Lord, then the mind stops acting on its own desires and by itself. And when it's dovetailed with the Lord, therefore, that is nirvana. So why is it called that? Because this idea that it doesn't have any other activity separate to the Lord. And the verse that's in that section that Kapila Dev speaks to his mother is, so he compares it to a flame, which after the oil has burned out, becomes extinguished. So in one sense, from a impersonalist perspective, it's considered that the flame has become extinguished, which is like nirvana, because it's, you know, it's cancelled out essentially. And the process of that form of type of practice or liberation is to cancel out the self's or the individual's existence. So, but obviously Kapila Dev is speaking from a devotional perspective. So again, Srila Prabhupada explains that this example means that, you know, when the flame is caused to manifest in a particular shape, form, nature, etc., based on the oil that it's burning. So the oil is the, obviously it's the fuel, but it's the, in our comparison, the oil are essentially our desires. So the desires which reside in ourselves manifest a flame, i.e. our existence in a particular way, because obviously the way that we are manifest is a reflection of our desires. That's the kind of the basis, is essentially the kind of the precursor to karma, because that's what drives us in a particular direction. So when that oil becomes burned out, then the flame becomes extinguished. But that doesn't mean that so Srila Prabhupada actually says that according to the theory of conservation of energy, the flame is not extinguished, it's transformed, because you can't. So in the same way, the jiva is a form of energy. So that can't be, you know, cancelled or destroyed. But Srila Prabhupada says that it's transformed. And in the same way that when you have this idea of the oil, so once our material desires or once the oil has burned out, then that manifestation of the flame changes. It becomes conserved. You can't see it in the same way, but it's conserved. So in the same way, the jiva, when our material desires become finished, then we attain this state of nirvana, which is essentially oneness with the Lord through the process of desire. So I thought it was a really helpful kind of analogy to help us understand this, sometimes what we hear about, you know, the flame and kind of merging and impersonal and personal, and how for devotees that means something. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, uses that famous example of the Upanishad about how, you know, in the from a material sphere, taking something from something may mean nothing, but that's not how the spiritual dimension works. So that's the first kind of bit about Srila Prabhupada's purport of the understanding how, when it's described how Bhishma Dev merges, and in the and in other parts of the Bhagavatam, also this description is sometimes given, how for us we're to understand it. The next part of the purport, actually, maybe can I take questions like as we go through it? Is that okay? Is there anything on that point? Anything that is confusing or I didn't explain properly? Yeah. Yeah.
Just a question. So you mentioned that when our material desires get transformed, then we can enter nirvana.
Yeah, just to clarify. So here Prabhupada's saying sometimes he says material desires become finished, but that's the same as becoming transformed, because the material desire is finished. They've just become spiritual desires. So whether you call it transforming or finished, it's the same thing.
So question there is, how can they be transformed?
Oh, okay. I mean, yeah. So actually that comes up in the purport because it's very much obviously related to the practice of Krishna. So at the end of this purport, Srila Prabhupada talks about Bhishma Dev's relationship with Krishna, and so we can speak about that there. Okay. Yes, Prabhu.
One question on desire, Prabhu. So material desires are finished. The desires that are exhibited by the pure living entity now, those desires are theirs or the Lord's? Could you just clarify?
The material desires.
No, he's cleared from material desires.
Oh, sorry, right? Yeah.
So his desires, yeah, they're his as a unique individual?
Oh, I see.
Or are they the... Yeah, because they're one with the Lord's.
Yeah.
Could you just?
That's actually Srila Prabhupada clarifies that that actually it's the same thing. There's no longer the distinction. That's what that oneness means. That now my desire is the Lord's desire. So it's not. It's gone beyond. I have my desire and I'm trying to dovetail it to the Lord's desire. It's that I am actually. My desire is the Lord's desire. So whatever the Lord desires, that's my desire. So there's no longer the distinction.
So the unique living entity's desire is not his now, it's actually the Lord's desire.
Yeah, in the sense that that the living entity is reciprocating with the Lord. So the Lord has a desire, and the jiva, the pure unconditioned soul, has that intimate relationship with Krishna to be able to reciprocate, to fulfill his desire. So that's the only desire that the jiva has, is to fulfill the desires of the Lord.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. So the next section is, Srila Prabhupada says, this point about the living beings being component parts and parcels. So Srila Prabhupada said that the parts and parcels, we hear this analogy Prabhupada give many times about how like parts of a machine, they all are forming part of that machine, and therefore that's their utility. So he says that the Lord is served by his parts and parcels. And then he makes quite a heavy statement. Well, it's not that heavy, but it says, any part of the machine removed from the whole is no longer important. Similarly, any part and parcel of the absolute detached from service of the Lord is useless. So it's quite like a, you know, could be quite a stark statement in terms of essentially the uselessness of everyone in the material world. So I was thinking about this, and one of the points of that we were discussing in another group was this. You know, this you've probably read this book called by Viktor Frankl called "Man's Search for Meaning." I don't know if you're any. So he's a psychologist who did some research on how individuals survived the concentration camps, and he was actually, you know, he was imprisoned within a concentration camp along with his family, and he did a lot of research in the camp itself while he was undergoing that, and then post that. And one of the key points that he makes, which has become quite influential in terms of the field of psychology, is this idea that the real value of the self, he says in that book, the real value of the self is based on their spiritual understanding. So, like, people who are going through something which was so kind of traumatic as a concentration camp, that many of them lost a sense of self-worth. And he said that those who didn't lose that sense of self-worth, those who survived the concentration camp, not just physically survived, but actually mentally survived it, that their sense of value was rooted in their spiritual understanding. And this was, when I read that, I thought that was a really quite a profound point that he's understanding through his observation, and that we obviously understand through the Bhagavatam as well, that without that spiritual foundation or rooting, what to speak of like somebody else saying that, you know, like, you know, Srila Prabhupada's making the point that the part is not useful if it's not part of the whole, because it's not serving its function. It's only when it's in that place that it's serving its function. So in the same way, this idea that we genuinely develop a sense of, you know, a real sense of worth once we understand the spiritual identity. Because if you're just talking about the material identity, then actually the material identity is worth very little. You know, I think they teach it in science class, right, that the human body is worth about 60 pence in terms of its chemical composition. So it's not worth a lot. So actually, if you want to take out the spiritual side of it, then what Prabhupada is saying is absolutely factual. It's not worth anything. If you want to give worth to it because of the spiritual side of it, then that's exactly what Srila Prabhupada is saying, that spiritual worth becomes worthful once it's like, you know, if you have like an Intel chip and it's lying on the table and it's not in the computer, well, it's not really worth much. It's only, but it has value. It has intrinsic value. And that value is realized when it's in its proper place. So in the same way, the soul has intrinsic value, but it manifests that value when it's that part of the machine is placed in its proper place. Does that make sense? Okay. Is that all right? Are we ready to move on? Or anyone want to comment? No? Yeah, Prue?
Just a comment, maybe you can elaborate.
Yeah, please.
We see in modern psychology low self-esteem.
Yeah, yeah.
But this point seems to be making it very clear that our real self-esteem is the servant of the Lord.
Yeah.
If we don't identify that with that, we'll always have low self-esteem of one type or another.
Exactly. That's exactly what this point is making. That it's false, actually, in many ways. It's, you know, I use this as a basis for some of the teacher training that we do in the schools, and the title of that session was "Let's Not Lie to Them," and this idea that as teachers we shouldn't lie to students about, you know, whether it's chasing happiness will make you happy. All the academic research shows that's not true, and yet we still push it. You know, this idea that we can have self-worth based on so many external things, it causes so much psychological damage. So even though academically we understand that to be true, educationally we understand that to be true, yet because modern society seems to have this such a strong secular atheistic thread to it which pushes against anything spiritual, then that people feel like a need to almost sanitize everything from spirituality, and that's why I think we have to push against that. That actually, if you want to talk about self-worth, you have to talk about the spirit. You have to talk about spiritual development, because if you don't, you're doing a disservice, but also everything, all the evidence shows it doesn't work.
Prabhupada's calling it a slaughterhouse education.
Sometimes we see that those who are connected to Krishna, engaged in Krishna service, still feel a sense of uselessness or lack of self-worth, or that they're not useful in any way. So can you maybe say something about that?
Yeah.
And how even sometimes those who are in a spiritual movement, who are connected to Krishna and who do feel a sense of self-worth, that self-worth may also not be based on anything that substantial.
Yeah. I think Srila Prabhupada does talk about that as well in terms of how we interpret humility, terms like dānya, etc., in terms of our own perspective on that. And there's lots of articles that have been written kind of subsequent to that. I think just in summary, my understanding is that, and in this context, is that when we are on a conditioned level, because we don't have a complete spiritual understanding, it's a mixed understanding. So we're trying to cultivate a spiritual understanding, but we still have a strong material attachment. So we're still identifying with the body. And therefore, that sense of self-worth, because we are influenced sometimes by the mode of ignorance, can fall into depression, as opposed to propelling us upwards towards surrendering to Krishna, to take shelter of Krishna. So that's the dynamic sometimes we get wrong, because the mode of goodness would push us to take shelter of Krishna. I'm not worth anything, therefore the intelligence should tell me I should take shelter of the person who's worth everything. So, like part and parcel, and so it's a natural thing. But if I'm influenced by the mode of ignorance, then naturally, and that's why one of the descriptions of the mode of ignorance is depression, because what it does is it can drag us downwards as opposed to upwards. So as far as we are materially conditioned, we have to, balance that in terms of how we interpret that and apply that. But that doesn't mean that we can take away the absolute spiritual understanding, which is highlighted around this term dānya, that actually it does mean a sense of utter uselessness, that we do feel. So there's two things. One is how it's applied on a spiritual level, because that unconditioned, pure soul that exhibits dānya or utter humility doesn't fall into depression. They go on to, incredible things. So that's the balance. I think sometimes prematurely, if we go down a certain route, then it can cause a problem. But that doesn't mean that we can deny the absolute philosophy, which is that humility is an absolutely core aspect. And the gateway, dānya is described as the gateway to prema. Without first cultivating that, we can't achieve prema. Yes, Maji. Sorry, is there a mic for...
I'm wondering about how can one in this day and life achieve that state of being like Bhishma Dev? Because in my experience, people from young have been through that process, like from young gone through the Gurukul and grew up with this spiritual, absolute, clear-cut life, and they still have this longing desire for material things. How is it decided? Who decides that you are purely that level to achieve nirvana?
I can obviously just speak theoretically from what I've read. I understand that it's in terms of who decides, in terms of that progression and which direction and what's right for what person at what stage. Because to your point about going through a childhood and then retaining material desires, I think just a few things, because it's something that's quite close to what I do day to day. I think in one sense, it's natural. So I don't think we should be completely surprised that people grow through early years and their childhood and youth and retain material desires. I don't think that we should be too surprised about that, because it's a very difficult thing to do, to become free from material desires. And I think almost in a sense it's unfair on those children to expect them to be free from material desires. And I think sometimes that perspective adds a bit of undue pressure. I think the other thing is that what we also sometimes see is that when young people grow up, they essentially are living, especially in their younger years, they're essentially living on what I call like borrowed faith. So they're borrowing their faith from their parents and others around them, who they see doing things and they imitate and et cetera, et cetera. And they show signs of great faith, but actually it's imitation, which is natural again. And Bhagavatam talks about that too. And but at a certain point, that faith has to become theirs. They have to own it, has to become internalized. And unless, and sometimes if we scaffold them too much, particularly once they get to their teens, then they can't do that. And then, you know, late teens, early 20s, they start to actually challenge that faith, because it's never become theirs. They were never given an opportunity to make it theirs, to actually challenge the faith that they are borrowing in their younger years. So I think that environment or that culture of correctly developing and helping nurture that faith in a secure way, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur also talks about how at different points in a child's age, at the age of 8 and at the age of 14, there are different points at which different people come together, well-wishers, parents, elders, the guru, the teacher, you know, the child himself. So there's a very holistic approach to how that comes about. And it's a, you know, one of the other points in this purport is that gradual elevation, which we'll come on to, and I'll speak about that then. Okay, so the next section is about how, so that's a bit around that. Okay, so the next bit is, when the living being becomes conscious of this fact, this idea that he is conditioned and in the material realm, and there are unconditioned souls in the spiritual realm. So Srila Prabhupada says, when the living being becomes conscious of this fact, he tries to go back home, back to Godhead. And thus the spiritual urge of the living being begins. This spiritual urge is called Brahma Jignasa, or inquiry about Brahman. Principally, this Brahma Jignasa is successful by knowledge, renunciation, and devotional service. So this is this idea, actually, that to the point I was just made, the Vedic system is designed, actually, to spark this Brahma Jignasa, this urge. And the way it does that is to first to regulate, and then to regulate activity, which is the very basic level from animal life, then to introduce some level of piety. And through that material piety, one gets used to offering things to the Lord. And through habitual tendencies towards offering everything to the Lord, one becomes curious as to who is that Lord, and why am I doing this? And then one begins at this level, the spiritual aspect of that Vedic kind of traditional journey begins. And obviously Srila Prabhupada gave us a shortcut to that. But that's essentially what here, in terms of this urge being developed. And, you know, there's that verse, like, so here Srila Prabhupada says, this Brahma Jignasa is successful by knowledge, renunciation, and devotional service. And there's that verse, Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga Shikshate Meka Purusha Purana Shri Krishna Chaitanya Shri Dadari Kapam Budhir Yastam Aham Prapadye. So this Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga, so Vairagya, renunciation, Vidya, knowledge, same as Jnana, and Nija Bhakti, devotion unto himself. These three things Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to teach us. So sometimes there's this question, obviously, that arises that, well, why are we talking about vairagya and vidya? Here, Srila Prabhupada is saying it's become successful by renunciation and knowledge and devotional service, when actually we really focus on devotional service. Again, this idea of that, which pertains to the earlier section, that actually it's a process which in a kind of external varnashram system is a gradual elevation from knowledge, once I have knowledge, then I have knowledge that the material world is what it is, and the spiritual world is what it is, and therefore I become renounced, and that renunciation leads me to devotion. So it's a gradual process. Whereas in devotional service, when we're practicing it directly, this vairagya vidya is contained within the process of devotional service, and therefore doesn't need to be practiced independently. And that's the difference. So that it's not that vairagya and vidya are not useful, it's that they are useful, otherwise that verse wouldn't exist, vairagya vidya nija bhakti yoga verse. They are useful, but they don't need to be practiced independently from the process of devotional service. That's what Srila Prabhupada explains. Does that make sense? So that's why sometimes the texts and purports say, you know, the devotees don't need to worry about vairagya and vidya. And sometimes they say devotees have to practice vairagya and vidya. And the point is just that vairagya and vidya are important elements and components of bhakti, not independent of bhakti. Okay. So there's a bunch of other stuff on that, but I'm going to skip that just because we're coming up to time. So the next section that I just wanted to touch on was... Okay, so the next section, Srila Prabhupada talks about how the successful living beings enter into the realm of the Absolute. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki jai, Shri Shri Sitalam Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Shri Shri Gornitai ki jai. So then Srila Prabhupada says that the jnanis and the yogis and the bhaktas, so these three are eligible to enter into the realm of the Absolute, the jnanis, the yogis, and the bhaktas. Right, so Prabhupada says the jnanis and yogis enter into the impersonal rays, and the bhaktas enter into the spiritual planets. Yeah, so we know that Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, and therefore, and in the spiritual planets they reciprocate with Krishna in those in the different rasas. So here, Srila Prabhupada says that, you know, whilst they're entering into the impersonal rays, these jnanis and the yogis, so sometimes the description is given of personalities who are liberated, like Brahma is a good example, so the liberation of Brahma. So it's described that Brahma is liberated at the end of his life. But that can sometimes mean that liberation at the Mahavishnu level, which is within the Brahma Jyoti. And then having to return at the start of the next universal creation. So there's these two different types, and that return to the material world is based on this idea that as long as there is this conception of being one with the Lord in the impersonal viewpoint, then there's necessary to come back. What I found really interesting, I read this point in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, that when Arjun, you know, when Arjun's going through the different planetary systems, and then he reaches the outer section, and then he enters into the Brahman effulgence, and there he says, so this is a quote from that section. So he says, when Arjun saw that Brahmacharya, then there he saw Lord Mahakal, who is Mahavishnu. And he says, then I saw in the ether a brilliant light. This is the Brahma Jyoti. It pervaded the entire cosmos, yet was situated in one place in a personal form. And that section is really quite interesting because I hadn't appreciated it until I read it. in the Priya Bhagavatamrita, that there is this idea that actually in the Brahma Jyoti, there are two aspects. There is one is what we commonly understand in terms of the Brahma Jyoti being the impersonal nature. But within that, the Lord also manifests his personal form. And the jivas within the Brahma Jyoti are given an opportunity to engage in personal reciprocation with the Lord, should they so wish. The trouble is that most of them don't wish, but it's described there that they have that opportunity. And those who take it can be elevated from the, you know, like sometimes it's said from the Brahma Jyoti, one can go to the spiritual world. So again, I was trying to figure out how is that true, but this section explains it because it says that Lord Mahavishnu in that Brahma Jyoti gives the jiva the opportunity to engage in personal service. If the jiva takes that service, he then gets promoted to the spiritual world. If he doesn't, then he has to come back to the material world, typically at the restart of the next creation, because the jivas become absorbed in Mahavishnu and then back out again. So that was like an interesting point, I thought, that's clarified in that section. Any questions on that? Because I know that's quite a confusing thing sometimes. So is the mic? So Prabhuji here.
Hare Krishna. Is there any difference between the destination of the yogis and the gyanis, even though it's described there, any subtle difference in their destination? Would the yogis be approaching that personal form within the Brahma Jyoti or not?
Yeah, it's so what is described is that, also in the third canto, is that the yogis have, obviously their goal is the Paramatma realization. Srila Prabhupada says that Paramatma realization is actually to an extent, a greater extent, mechanical. And therefore, only when that Paramatma realization leads and is not tinged with that impersonal approach to Paramatma, to become one with Paramatma, then the yogis can go beyond that, and it leads to spontaneous devotional service because they see the Lord and therefore want to serve the Lord. So the yogis essentially through their journey always have that kind of dual, you know, choice, if you like. They have the choice of these two things. That one, some yogis, and that's again why there's sometimes Srila Prabhupada talks about yogis in these two ways, mystic yogis, Ashtanga yogis we're talking about, that when they reach the point of samadhi, they can either go down one path or another path. And Srila Prabhupada actually says that this, you know, the Bhaktisarya Swami was speaking yesterday about the eight stages of the Ashtanga system. So the seventh stage, dhyan, before samadhi, Srila Prabhupada says that dhyan stage is the third stage of devotional service. You know? So shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu smaranam. So that stage of vishnu smaranam is the dhyan stage of yoga. Now then at that stage, from vishnu smaranam then comes padasayam, narachanam, vandanam. So then the opportunity for service arises. If the yogi takes the opportunity to develop that spontaneous devotional service, then they get promoted to the spiritual world. Otherwise, they can stay on the platform, and if they take an impersonal route, then they'll go to the Brahma Jyoti. Okay, so then the last section, which is about Bhishma Dev. Srila Prabhupada says that Bhishma Dev, as a pure devotee of the Lord, entered the spiritual realm in one of the Vaikuntha planets where the Lord in his eternal form of Parthasarathi predominates. So this is a Vaikuntha planet. The Lord on that planet is called Parthasarathi. And Parthasarathi is, as we know, Krishna as the chariot driver of Arjuna. And this is epitomizes really Bhishma Dev's rasa with the Lord, because Bhishma Dev is a personification essentially of the rasa of chivalry, and the chivalrous kind of engagement with Krishna, his rasa with Krishna, is Krishna on the battlefield driving Arjuna's chariot. So here it corresponds with that. And then Srila Prabhupada says that the love and affection which bind the Lord and devotee are exhibited in the case of Bhishma Dev. Bhishma Dev never forgot the Lord in his transcendental feature as Parthasarathi, and the Lord was present personally before Bhishma Dev while he was passing to the transcendental world. So this is again, you know, there's that famous verse, it's engraved in the garden, in the rose gardens over there, which says that glorious is that devotee who does not give up the shelter of his Lord, and glorious is that Lord who does not abandon his servant. This idea that it's that Krishna becomes famous and glorious for how he reciprocates with his devotee, and we see that through all of the pastimes, and the devotee becomes famous for how the devotee takes absolute shelter or unflinching shelter of the Lord. And Krishna's is described also that, you know, what is Krishna's most kind of like his, what is his greatest feature of his personality? So he has so many wonderful qualities and like that. And what is the, what is his greatest feature? And it's described that his essentially, his subservience to his devotee is that feature which distinguishes Krishna from all other forms of the Lord. That his subservience to, because that, if you see the different moods and rasas that are displayed through the spiritual world and different parts of the spiritual world, what is it that's so special about Raja Bhakti and that idea that actually there, Krishna is no longer God. He is who he is, and he enjoys serving his devotees as much as they enjoy serving him. And here, Srila Prabhupada is saying that this idea that Bhishma never forgot Krishna, regardless of what situation he was in, he never forgot Krishna at this stage, and Krishna never forgot him. And therefore, this idea is emphasized again. And before we just open up again to any comments, I just wanted to summarize some of the key points that were made earlier in this chapter about why Bhishma Dev finds himself in this situation, because it reflects on the character and nature of Bhishma Dev, like his, because this is the last verse, I think, after this, I think it goes on to some other points of the story. So there is an external perspective, and then there's the internal perspective. And the external perspective is, of course, that Bhishma was attached to duty, and he was morally bound, and he fought on the wrong side, and he ended up in the situation, and he wanted to give instruction. And because he was well-versed in all of these scriptures, he spoke to Yudhishthira. So that's of course, there. But earlier in the chapter, if you recall, there are a few things, points, really important points that are made that actually when Yudhishthira, when they finished the battle and Yudhishthira was so like distraught at the whole situation, different people tried to console him. So Vyas tried to console him. Even Krishna himself tried to console Yudhishthira. But Yudhishthira was not consolable. Now, how can Krishna try to console him and not be consolable? The only way that he can not be consoled by Krishna is because Krishna didn't want him to be consoled by what he said. So Krishna specifically externally showed that he was consoling Yudhishthira, but he didn't want him to be consoled because he wanted to glorify Bhishma. So he wanted to say, okay, you're not consoled by me, you're not consoled by Vyas, you're not consoled by all of these others, so then go to Bhishma. And after Bhishma's instructions, Yudhishthira was somewhat pacified. And in the same light, you know, all of these sages, all of these Narada Muni, the Kumara, all of these great personalities are gathered, yet Krishna is saying, you take instructions from Bhishma. Like Vyas is there, everybody's there. Krishna is saying, you take instruction from Bhishma. And he's saying that again because he wants to glorify Bhishma. And so these are, you know, like it's described that Bhishma, just like the Pandavas, is an eternal associate. So sometimes we see things from, like, you know, why didn't he say something during the attempted disrobing, or why did he do this? Why did he fight on the side of the Kauravas, etc.? So sometimes we see this aspect of it, and that also has its external explanation, but there's an internal thing going on as well. And what was also another point that was made through this was that, you know, Bhishma took, like the devotee is described, often takes on this thankless task of performing a certain role in Krishna's pastimes, which is going to be criticized for ever, essentially. And they take on that task because to fulfill, you know, Krishna's plan. And what Bhishma wanted to show through his situation was that it doesn't matter how great you are. It doesn't matter if you're the greatest fighter on the planet. It doesn't matter if you have a boon that you can never die. It doesn't matter how knowledgeable you are. If you're fighting on the wrong side, i.e. if you're fighting against Krishna, you're not going to win. So he wanted to exemplify this idea that regardless of who you are, so what to speak of, you know, persons who are lesser, even somebody like Bhishma, if they're not on Krishna's side, it's just not going to work. Okay, so we have a couple of minutes if anybody would like to ask or make any final comments or points.